This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
As Washington prepares for Inauguration Day next week, a congressman reflects on going to work right now at the U.S. Capitol.
We have more people in uniform at the United States Capitol right now than we do in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. There's a lot to process.
I speak with Representative Andy Kim from New Jersey. Also today, when it comes to wind, bigger is better. Taller turbines equals more energy.
It's exciting to me. Just the scale, the sheer scale of these things is sort of amazing. It's almost impossible to imagine.
And in China, Beijing's green agenda can come with ulterior motives.
Using environmental protection to accomplish authoritarian ends.
And for some Syrian refugees in Canada, the first word they learn is Zamboni. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to be with you today. The events last week at the U.S. Capitol became a very visual story. One image that stuck out to many of us, a photo of a member of Congress in suit and tie, on his hands and knees cleaning up the mess from the rioters. Congressman Andy Kim kneeling on the floor, gathering debris and putting garbage in a trash bag. The New Jersey Democrat is the son of South Korean immigrants. He says that simple act, grabbing a trash bag and filling it, gave him in that moment a kind of solace.
It was terrible to see this room that I love so much, this Capitol building that is the most beautiful building in the country, treated in that way. And I just wanted to do what I could to restore it to the condition that it deserves, to treat it with the respect that it deserves. So I picked up a trash bag and spent about an hour and a half cleaning up around the Capitol in a couple different areas.
What were you thinking in those hours?
In some ways, actually, it was very kind of therapeutic. I could just focus in on just making the room as beautiful as I could. It gave me a very tangible task, a way that I could just literally pick up the pieces and try to get the building and our democracy moving forward.
So almost kind of started cleaning by impulse. Now, a week later, how have you processed those terrible events?
I'll be honest, it's hard. And the impeachment process, and there's so many threads to that. I'm processing the fact that yesterday I saw thousands of U.S. uniformed service members, National Guardsmen, in the halls of our Congress, quartered there for the first time since the Civil War. We have more people in uniform at the United States Capitol right now than we do in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. There's a lot to process. Right now, what goes through my mind is just, how did it get this bad? And what do we do to pull out of this tailspin that we're in right now?
Yeah, I mean, how did it get this bad? And what do you think you can do to turn things around?
I think one thing we have to just recognize is the reality, which is that it's going to be a long road to recovery ahead. This is not going to just go away on January 20th like a light switch when Biden comes in. So we need to recognize just how bad the problem is and that it's going to be a long-term effort. But I think why maybe that photo of me resonated and why it is honestly that I did it is that I think we need to start with a foundation of respect, respect for our democracy, which means respect for the building of our democracy, the temple of our democracy, and respect for each other as Americans. Right now, we're at a place where people do not see each other as Americans first, that we see these divisions artificially built to separate us and create enemies where they should not be. I think it has to start with a certain level of decency and civility and respect. I know that that feels so hard right now, so I'm not being naive here. I understand that it'll be tough, but I think that that is necessary for us to be able to move forward.
You're not new to public service, Representative Kim. You worked at the State Department in Afghanistan. You were a civilian advisor to Generals David Petraeus and John Allen. You have seen a government on the ropes, a government in collapse before. Does that give you a different perspective from some of your colleagues in this moment, do you think?
Well, it certainly shapes my perspective. You know, I spent years of my life working on trying to find common ground between Sunnis and Shia, between Arabs and Kurds in Kirkuk, Iraq. And this is what I was trained to do. I never necessarily thought that I would use these skills here or that background here at home. But I've seen countries where there are deep divisions, where people are otherizing their neighbors and failing to see the commonality. And I saw how it rips them apart, you know, rips these societies apart. And I'm fearful because I see what radicalization can do. And I worry that it's happening right in our own country.
Congressman, you're the son of Korean immigrants. Have you spoken with your family, your parents, about what happened last week and the ongoing threat from extremists?
I have. And I remember calling my mother while the insurrection was happening. And, you know, she was just crying over the phone as if she was here, too. And I think a lot of people around the country, around the world, felt very personal about this because it's a building that means so much to everybody. I remember my mother and my father bringing me to the Capitol when I was a child. You know, my dad grew up, you know, mom grew up during the Korean War and the immediate aftermath. My dad grew up in an orphanage as a polio survivor, ended up getting a PhD in genetics here in America. You know, that story and his arc and my parents, it's just so poignant. And they brought me to the Capitol and they showed me the Capitol and they taught me to love and respect that building. So I think my mom was right there with me, and I know she could feel it.
You know, it was hard not to notice the contrast after the ransacking of the Capitol. The cleanup of the rotunda seemed to be largely of people of color cleaning up a mess made largely by a group of white rioters. Is that what you saw? And what do you see as a subtext?
Yeah, I don't think you can look at those images and not take away some measure of contrast. And actually, you know, I remember talking to some of the cleaning staff and some of the guards in the following days, and one of them came up to me and said something that I just will never forget. They said, I could see in that photo that you love this building as much as I do. And I think that, you know, for people who are immigrants or sons and daughters of immigrants or people who have been in disenfranchised communities and minority communities, you know, we don't take anything for granted.
We learned today that the entire National Mall will be closed on Inauguration Day next Wednesday. The public, for the most part, won't be able to see the swearing-in of President-elect Biden in person because of the ongoing threats. What do you make of that?
It's sad but necessary. I've been briefed on the threats, and they are real. There are real threats that are calling for thousands of people to come and encircle the Capitol, to come and encircle the Washington Monument, the White House, to try to block the president-elect from being able to get into the White House after the swearing-in. I mean, I don't know if this is all going to pan out. I, having worked in counterterrorism before, I know there's a difference between what is aspirational and what is operational, but I'm worried. I'm going to be there at the inauguration. I'm going to be there to be able to show that America is resilient, but I will not feel 100% safe. Even with tens of thousands of uniformed individuals around, what January 6th shook to the core is that anything is possible. If we see an insurgency in our most treasured building right now, anything is possible. And that is a scary place. And that's a scary place for me as a father, two baby boys to be raising here in America. And that's why I'm recommitting myself to doing everything I can to fix that.
Well, I think your action and the photo is helpful for a lot of people. New Jersey Democrat Representative Andy Kemp, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
After a turbulent run-up, it's finally election day in Uganda today. Millions of people went to the polls to vote for president. There have been concerns about violence. Also, the internet has been down across Uganda since yesterday. Yoweri Museveni is the incumbent in this race. He's been in office more than 30 years. The leading opposition candidate is the pop singer-turned-politician Bobi Wine. The world's Halima Gikandi is in Kampala, where she's been speaking with voters.
So I'm out of polling place in Kisubu, which is an area in Kampala. Polling stations have been set up here at a soccer pitch. Right now, it's in the evening, so all of the ballots have actually been cast. What's happening now is people are counting the votes. maybe around 200 people, if not more here, a lot of young people. And what's happening is there are a couple polling agents. They're picking out, they've separated the votes and they're counting them one by one. Most of the people here are Bobby Wine supporters. And so when we hear the polling agent announce who wins, we've been hearing a lot of cheers, but also a lot of some kind of scuffles over whether or not certain votes should actually be counted. But I'm here with a young man named Ali Fawz Faizid, and he is a voter. And tell me, Ali, what's the biggest issue on your mind as after you cast your vote today?
My mind was all about changing the presidential candidate, where I voted for Chagulani Sentamu, known as Bobi Wine, as the figure knows in all areas around the world.
And of course, when you say Chagulani, you mean Bobi Wine, as he's known in many parts of the world. So tell me a bit about yourself. How old are you?
For me, I'm 20 years old by age, and this is my first vote as a Ugandan citizen.
It's your first time voting?
Yeah.
And what exactly do you want to see changed here?
The people who are leading us as the high presidential candidates, yeah, are all corrupted. So that issue I had in mind, so I decided to change vote for President Chagulani Sentamu.
Thank you so much for your time. That was a polling agent. Again, he's literally sifting through each vote one by one. And when he says umbrella, that's the sign of Bobi Wine and his party. I spoke with the local chairman of this area a bit earlier, and he said that, yes, Chagulani, also known as Bobi Wine, is leading, but number two under that is President Museveni. So it just goes to show how close this race could be. And this is only one polling station of, you know, tens of thousands across the country. And once the results here are finished, the results will be sent to the National Tally Center, which is in a different part of Kampala. And they don't expect to have the final results until Saturday.
Halima joins me on the line now from Kampala. It sounds like there was no violence at that polling place, as some feared, the polling place you were at. But across Kampala today, Halima, what was the atmosphere as far as you saw?
Yes, in Kampala, the streets themselves were pretty quiet. There actually wasn't the usual even traffic that we see on a typical day. It seemed like most people were staying at home. A lot of businesses were shuttered. But at the polling stations themselves, as you just heard, those have been busy. There were long lines, people waiting to vote, a big turnout, especially from the youth. And people told me anecdotally that this was the largest turnout that they had seen in recent years.
We have to remember, though, that political temperatures in Uganda have been running so high. How much confidence do voters have about the fairness of today's vote?
Great question. I mean, I've heard different mixed things. Of course, in the lead-up of this election, as you mentioned, there have been instances of violence where supporters, especially of Bobi Wine, or even regular citizens caught in the crosshairs of demonstrations, have been killed. Other people have been disappeared. So that was a worry that was real and that was on people's minds. Today, we didn't really see that as far as we know, but I have to point out that the big problem has been there's no internet. There's no social media. So all of us have our ears and eyes glued to the local radio and TV, and that's all the information we get about what's actually happening.
Wow. So finally, Halima, Yoweri Museveni, he's had such a firm grip on power for so long. What if Bobi Wine turns out to win this election in the final count? Do people think Uganda has a good chance then to pull off a smooth transition of power?
Some Ugandans I've spoken with honestly said they think the election will be rigged, even though they still went out to vote regardless. Some people think that Bobi Wine will be the true winner, but that ultimately on Saturday, the 70th will be announced as the winner by the Electoral Commission. Other people are more confident, so it's mixed. That said, in local media this morning, President Museveni was asked the question, would he accept the results of the election? And he more or less said, yes, he would. That said, we'll see on Saturday when the election results come out what actually happens.
Well, Museveni says he'll accept the results. We will wait for those results, and we'll see what happens. The world's Halima Gikandi in Kampala, Uganda, covering the presidential election there. Halima, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. It's not really surprising anymore when we hear the latest heat records. NASA says 2020 was the hottest year on record, even if by just a smidge. Liz Howe is a senior scientist at the agency.
This year, 2020, just edged out 2016 only slightly by a few hundredths of a degree as the hottest year on record. However, they're nominally tied. They're so close.
NASA and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, released their annual global temperature data today. Due to slight measurement differences, NOAA is calling this year a bit differently as the second hottest ever.
But I think what's important to look at is if you start looking at the long-term trends, you'll see that the last 7 years are the seven hottest years on record. And that's a record that extends back to 1880.
2016 was an El Nino year when temperatures are naturally expected to be a bit higher. That makes 2020's temps even more significant. Overall, global warming has pushed Earth's average temperature up more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the 1880s. Liz Howe with NASA says Arctic regions are warming even faster, 3 times the rate compared to the rest of the world.
And so you're seeing thawing permafrost up there, you're seeing melting sea ice, and I think that as we see these global temperatures going up, we're going to see even more of an impact in Arctic regions. But what happens in Arctic areas doesn't just stay there.
That's because melting at the poles leads to higher sea levels everywhere. China may be the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the world. The U.S. is still the largest on a per capita basis. But China is also at the forefront of renewable energy innovation and also has some of the world's largest conservation projects. Beijing is trying to get to net zero carbon emissions by the year 2060. That means contributing no additional greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Yifei Li is studying just how China can get there. He's an environmental researcher at New York University Shanghai and the author of the recent book, China Goes Green. Yifei, in your book, you talk about how China's ambitious goals envision an ecological civilization. How would you describe what's at the heart of the Chinese government's vision and goals for 2060?
The Chinese government is seeing and using this term ecological civilization as a national strategy. And they're doing this to really describe the Chinese Communist Party as an actor that tries to restore China back to its former glory. So the official history that the Communist Party has been teaching its people and has been peddling in official historiography is that China had a glorious past. And it's not just any kind of glory, not just any kind of civilizational leader. The Chinese Communist Party sees itself as building a uniquely ecological kind of civilizational leadership for the world.
Ecological civilization does sound like a noble goal, but you also describe China's green ambitions as coercive environmentalism. Explain that.
The idea being that if the goal of environmental protection is noble enough and important enough, and perhaps we can use that goal to justify the means of authoritarianism. In other words, using authoritarian approaches to accomplish environmental protection goals. What the Chinese government seems to be doing systematically at home and overseas is using environmental protection to accomplish authoritarian ends.
Right. Well, in your book, to get specific, Yifei, you describe how the Chinese government has used the pretense of environmentalism to exert control over communities. Give us some examples of that.
Very much so. We're seeing the Chinese government using, for example, facial recognition technologies to control how citizens sort their garbage and recycle under the pretense of a national park initiative or a conservation program. They are systematically relocating ethnic minority groups to create new national parks. On what China calls the Belt and Road Initiative, the Chinese government is pursuing a lot of government-to-government deals, once again, in the name of environmental protection, but these projects turn out to be categorically insensitive to dissenting voices. We're seeing the Chinese government using environmental protection as a reason to intensify trade manipulation.
So does this model work either in service to the environment or to human or civil rights?
The success of China's brand of state-led environmentalism doesn't depend on a strong state. And in fact, the success depends on mechanisms that place Chinese state power in check. We see successful moments of Chinese coercive environmentalism when the state is open to public inputs from all sorts of non-state channels. To give you an example, the Chinese government developed this interesting app, which everybody can download, that's called Black and Smelly Waters. Now, through this app, the local authorities are getting inputs from the public. When they see a polluted body of water, they snap a picture and send them to the government through this app. And the government then send their inspectors what really can help the Chinese government achieve long-term environmental success is opening up the Chinese state to inputs from various walks of the society.
And what about the downside of civil rights with this model?
We've seen examples such as hydrological developments where large-scale hydropower dams are put in place without fully consulting various communities whose lives are affected. And when these projects go ahead, they not only have very substantial human costs, in fact, they turn out to have very significant environmental damages over the long run as well.
China is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. They also have one of the most ambitious plans to go carbon neutral in the world, aiming to reach net zero emissions, as I said, by 2060. How do you think the government ultimately plans to get there? Will the policy continue to revolve around a government that remains insular?
There seems to be a very strong emphasis that China will continue to develop its carbon cap and trade mechanism domestically. That is a worrying sign. The Chinese government essentially has granted itself, or will grant itself, sweeping power in determining who will have these allowable emission credits that's assigned to them. Every business that there is will have some sort of a carbon footprint. I just don't know what kind of allocation mechanism will be the most equitable one. And if that mechanism is completely dictated by the Chinese government, there will be some worrying consequences down the road.
Whether we like it or not, will the rest of the world in the years going forward be essentially following in China's environmental footsteps, its policy, simply by virtue of the massive scale China presents?
A lot of the things that China has been doing are indeed environmentally beneficial, at least in the short term. But I don't think we're in a position to make environmental gains by paying social and cultural costs of these environmental programs. This is an opportunity for the whole world to come together to better deliberate what really are the kind of future that we want.
Yifei Li is an environmental researcher at New York University Shanghai and the author of the recent book, China Goes Green. He's been speaking with us from Shanghai. Yifei Li, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up later this hour, why bigger is better when tackling climate change. We're talking wind turbines, of course. You're listening to The World. Coming up, Brazilians are dealing with disappointing vaccine trials. The U.S. bans some Chinese cotton. And if you're a Syrian kid who has relocated to Canada, what do you do in your new country?
I like to play hockey.
You slap on the skates and hit the ice. That's still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Here in the U.S., more than 10 million people have now received their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. It is a big number, but far short of the goal set by federal officials. The rollout here in the U.S. has been described by many as chaotic. Phone lines jammed, websites crashing, even seniors camping out overnight to get vaccinated. Logistical problems are not uniquely American, though. In Canada, like the U.S., the system is a patchwork. Each Canadian province has different rules, and premiers are clamoring for more doses.
All I need is vaccines. If there's one thing the federal government can do, and they're trying their best, we need more vaccines.
We haven't got enough water to fill the fire hose. We got enough water for a pop gun here, for a squirt gun.
Premiers Doug Ford of Ontario and Brian Pallister from Manitoba speaking there. Europe's rollout has also been plagued by problems. In parts of Germany, all the vaccine slots for the week are being scooped up in minutes by those lucky enough to get through on a vaccine hotline. On the other extreme is Israel. 1 in 5 Israelis have received an initial dose of vaccine, including Israelis in more remote, less populated areas. Israelis are splitting sets of doses from Pfizer into smaller lots. Israel's health minister, Yuli Edelstein, told Sky News that Israeli technology has allowed them to break down sets of 1,000 doses into easy-to-transport kits.
So now sometimes our paramedics or nurses are able to travel with a set of 50 to a very distant point without wasting one single shot.
A note, though, in the Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza, the vaccination rate is zero. One country that's not doing so well with the pandemic is Brazil, where we go now. Michael Fox is there and reports on a potential setback in Brazil's vaccination efforts.
It was not the news Brazilians wanted to hear. With more than 205,000 COVID-19 deaths to date, the country is the hardest hit after the United States. This week, it was announced that the efficacy of Brazil's top coronavirus vaccine was only just over 50%. The week before, it had been reported that it was close to 80%. The news made international headlines. Both Reuters and the New York Times called the results, quote, disappointing.
Por esse horário, o horário da coletiva, apresentamos os dados.
But during a two-hour-long press conference, researchers and members of the Sao Paulo Health Institute Butantan push back. They've been working with Sinovac, the Chinese company developing the vaccine. Ricardo Palacios is the medical director of the clinical trials. Palacios said, "This is an efficient vaccine. We have a vaccine that can control the pandemic by decreasing the intensity of the clinical illness." Butantan tested the vaccine in clinical trials for months on more than 9,000 participants, many frontline healthcare workers. According to Palacios, the vaccine prevented all of the serious and moderate cases of COVID-19, that is, all of the cases needing hospitalizations. It prevented against 78% of the mild cases in the clinical trials and reduced the total number of coronavirus cases in half. Well-known microbiologist Natalia Pasternak said this is a good vaccine for Brazil because it's easier to produce and distribute locally. Coronavac can remain without refrigeration for weeks if necessary.
Eles são bons resultados, resultados honestos de uma vacina que é perfeitamente.
She said they are good results, honest results, for a vaccine that is perfectly acceptable. I want this vaccine. I want my parents to take it. It is a vaccine that is possible for Brazil. For Wassim Prates Sayed, a researcher at the University of Sao Paulo's pro-vaccine union, the problem was the very poor communication by the Butantan Institute and the state of Sao Paulo, which released early information to the public that led to the confusion.
Foi muito ruim. Isso bota muito em xeque a confiança nas pessoas.
It was very bad, he says. This puts people's confidence in these vaccines into question. It was irresponsible, because a vaccine at 50% efficacy is not bad. It's actually very good. At least one person was happy to see this week's bad publicity over the vaccine. That's President Jair Bolsonaro joking with supporters. He says, 50%, that's a good one, right? Bolsonaro has long fought against the CoronaVac vaccine, in part because it's been developed by a Chinese company, and in part because the deal has been negotiated and pushed by his political rival, Sao Paulo Governor João Doria. Bolsonaro has shown more affection for the Oxford University AstraZeneca vaccine. A plane is leaving this week to collect 2 million doses from a lab in India. Bolsonaro has also openly criticized vaccines in general, and he says he won't take one because he's already had the virus. Researcher Wassim Sayed says this rhetoric is a problem.
Que muitos dos posicionamentos do presidente, o presidente Bolsonaro, e o governo em geral,
Sayed says many of the positions of Bolsonaro and his government in general have legitimized and helped the coronavirus denial groups, and in particular, the anti-vaxxers in Brazil. According to a late December poll, the percentage of Brazilians who said they would not get a vaccine rose to almost 28% of the population. But most are still on board for anything that will speed them through the pandemic, and Brazilians are anything if not resilient, finding humor even in the hardest of times.
quero sua picada mais gostosa e esse seu jeito de mostrar.
That is musician and composer Edu Krieger in a song he posted last week on Instagram. I want your lovely sting, he sings of the coronavac shot. It's a way of showing that China can be wonderful. Brazilian Army General and Health Minister Eduardo Pazuello has announced that the government vaccination campaign will begin this month, but the exact date is still in the air.
A vacina vai começar no dia D, na hora H.
On Tuesday, he said, the vaccination will begin on the D-Day and the H hour. In other words, it's going to happen. We'll let you know. Brazil's health regulatory agency, Anvisa, is yet to approve a vaccine, but the directors are expected to meet this Sunday to vote on both the CoronaVac and AstraZeneca vaccines. In the meantime, Brazilians are watching the rising COVID-19 death count. Over 1,000 people are dying a day. It's poised to get much worse before it gets better. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
In Canada, it's not an exaggeration to say hockey is more than just a sport. You could say, our friends of the North will say, hockey is life, deeply intertwined with Canadian culture and identity. The World's Bianca Hillier has found further evidence.
In many ways, Yaman Bey is just like any other 11-year-old kid in Canada.
I like to play hockey.
He told me his favorite part of hockey is scoring goals and winning games. But unlike many Canadian kids, Yaman didn't put on his first pair of skates until last year. He was born in Syria and fled to Newfoundland with his siblings and mom to escape the country's civil war. Yaman's mom, Fatima, says she didn't expect her son to pick up the sport. But before long, Yaman started asking to join the local league. Just one small problem. He didn't know how to skate, and he didn't have any gear. Which is where local coach Michael Doyle enters the story. He heard about Yaman, grabbed a pair of kid-sized skates, and took him to a nearby rink.
All right, keep going that way.
A short clip from that day shows Yaman wobbling a little bit.
The first time I fall, and the first time I didn't love it.
But he showed promise and wanted to keep at it. Coach Doyle told CBC News that he took to Twitter to see if anyone had extra skates or pads for the boy. Within 20 minutes, gear started showing up at his door.
People were just amazing. Like, the community just came together, and it was nothing like I've ever experienced or ever expected to have happen.
With gear in hand, Yaman didn't waste any time. He joined a local team and started practicing. Soon, he could keep up with the rest of them.
No, I'm good. I can skate hard, and I didn't fall, and I can have goal.
Yaman's mom, Fatima, says she's thankful for the help from her new Canadian neighbors. Yaman wakes up early to practice, 6 a.m., she says, and he really loves the sport. He's also made a bunch of friends on the ice, including two other Syrian refugee children, Arij and Anaz. Coach Doyle helped them, too, gather gear and sign up for the team. This story of refugees finding empowerment and community through sports isn't unique to Canadian hockey.
Sport is a tool that can help.
Sashka Benedicic-Tomut heads up the International Sports and Culture Association, or ISCA. They work in 90 countries to help refugees of all ages integrate into communities through local sports. Benedicic-Tomut says sports can offer a short break from the other stressors refugees face.
They feel that they can do something good for their body and for their health, because at the same time they are struggling with just the basic things that they need to do in their life.
Joining a team also leads to the more intangible goal of refugees becoming part of society.
They could go, I don't know, alone to the field or to the forest and run, but it's the belonging is important. So they belong to a team and they can work together. They can play football with someone, and then they can also interact with the locals. And this is how they get to know each other.
Importantly, Benedicic-Tomut says these interactions are also beneficial for local players.
Playing with refugees just opens our eyes and lives and hearts as well. We can't keep looking at refugees as a burden, as a cost. It's so important to look at that group as a competent group, as a group that can really bring something to us, to the table, to the club, to local community.
To help with that, ISCA offers free online courses to teach athletes and coaches how to welcome refugees to the field. Benedici Chitomat says with the right support, it's not uncommon for refugees to become managers or coaches of teams. For Yaman Bey in Canada, though, he just wants to keep playing hockey.
I feel very, very, very happy. I want to skate every day.
Yaman told me he wants to play for Canada's national team one day. And he's well on his way.
When we have the Christmas game, I have goal. The first goal for me.
Yaman scored his first goal during the Holiday Championship tournament this year. His team ended up winning, and Yaman left the ice with a gold medal around his neck, just 1 year after lacing up for the first time. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
If you've ever looked at a windmill and thought, why don't they just build them bigger? Bigger blades would capture more wind, right? There is a new turbine, one that towers over previous models, and it's changing the world of renewable energy. That's what we're checking out in our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The World's Anna Kussmer brings us to the coasts of Northern Europe to learn about the newest, biggest, baddest turbine on the market.
Towering over Rotterdam Harbor is the most powerful wind turbine spinning in the world. It's nearly as tall as the Eiffel Tower, each blade as long as a football field.
It's a fantastic engineering feat.
Steve Wilson oversees development of the wind farm that will use these turbines for the first time. They're built by GE, and they're called the Haliade X.
I think the first reaction when we were presented with the Haliade X was that it was a real step change for the global offshore wind industry.
Over the next 5 years, Wilson's company SSE Renewables will install dozens of these giant turbines in the Dogger Bank wind farm. That's off the UK coast in the North Sea.
It will be able to produce enough renewable energy for around 6 million homes, or roughly 5% of the UK's energy requirements.
The plan is to scale up by 2030, installing enough turbines in the North Sea to power half of the UK's energy needs. GE's bigger, better wind turbines make ambitious goals like that easier to accomplish, says energy policy expert Sarah Hastings Simon.
It's exciting to me. Just the scale, the sheer scale of these things is sort of amazing. It's almost impossible to imagine.
Hastings Simon is a researcher at the Colorado School of Mines.
They are, you know, taller than the Washington Monument. They're approaching the height of the Empire State Building. I mean, these are just enormous machines.
Their height means they can reach stronger, steadier winds at higher altitudes. And their size makes them able to capture a lot more wind per turbine.
Think about a single wind turbine. You know, one single sweep of one of these large wind turbines can power the average house for a day or two.
And power a small city all by itself. A wind farm that used to need, say, 500 conventional wind turbines would only need about 80 or 90 with this new design. That makes them much more cost efficient.
It's grown by a factor of 6 or 7 in just 15 years. It's beyond what I thought was possible.
Kees van der Loon in the Netherlands has been a renewable energy consultant for more than 3 decades. He says wind power has been getting cheaper, but this new model from GE is a game changer.
Thanks to these new turbines, but also all kinds of innovation, we have now achieved such a point that they're eminently affordable. So that's why we're now entering into an acceleration mode.
Van der Loon says he expects these turbines to pop up in offshore wind farms around the world in the next few years. China, Japan, and countries across Europe all have ambitious plans to lower their carbon emissions. There's also talk of putting them off the east coast of the U.S.
Biden especially has a very ambitious target.
The president-elect has vowed to decarbonize U.S. electricity by 2035.
That will really give a massive boost to the market in the U.S.
Of course, bigger, better wind turbines are not a silver bullet, says energy policy researcher Sarah Hastings Simon.
I think the basic thing is that we have to acknowledge that any kind of energy generation, has impacts.
Building them still takes resources, and they could disrupt ecosystems if they're not carefully situated. Still, Hastings Simon says she has a sort of bright-eyed excitement about technological leaps like this one. People used to think that a wind turbine this powerful would be impossible. So what other impossible things should we try next? For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
The Big Fix gives us a chance each week to think about climate change solutions, a few minutes to explore how people and groups around the planet are tackling the climate crisis. We also want to hear from you and your questions about climate change solutions. Email us at climate@theworld.org. Also, find more of our Big Fix stories at theworld.org/bigfix. The Trump administration is taking a step to crack down on some of China's worst human rights abuses. The U.S. is now banning imports of cotton and tomatoes from China's Xinjiang region. That's a semi-autonomous region in northwestern China, where Beijing has placed as many as 1 million Muslim Uyghurs in re-education camps. The U.S. government and human rights groups believe that China is using forced labor to pick these two crops, cotton and tomatoes. We wanted to learn more about the ban and the implications of it. Allison Gill joins me now. She's the Forced Labor Program Director with Global Labor Justice International Labor Rights Forum. Remind us briefly, Allison, who are the Uyghurs and what's their status in China?
The Uyghurs are an ethnic majority population in the Xinjiang Autonomous Uyghur region, which is a Chinese colonial term for the region. The Uyghurs refer to it as East Turkestan or the Uyghur region. And they and other majority Muslim and Turkic peoples in the region have been under repressive policies for years. China has termed them terrorists, has for decades sought to assimilate them into the Chinese population, into the Han population, through really coercive methods, stripping them of their rights to speak their language, to have privacy in the family, taking children to locked kindergartens, separating family members, sending Uyghurs outside of the Uyghur region to work, limiting birth, forced sterilizations, really crimes against humanity on a mass scale.
So this ban seems to be pretty important. What are some of the implications that will come out of it? I mean, for cotton, I have to imagine this is going to be a big deal for the garment industry.
That's right. This is a huge deal because China produces 20% of the world's cotton. Most of that is produced in the Uyghur region. In addition, a huge amount of textile production happens in the Uyghur region. And, you know, we talk about supply chains in the garment industry. They're really supply webs. So cotton moves from the fields to gins to spinneries where it's turned into thread and yarn, to textile mills where it's made into fabric, and then to factories where it's made into garments. These exist in the Uyghur region, in China, as well as elsewhere. So these goods are moving across country lines. So you might buy a shirt that's made in Vietnam, but it could have inputs that come from this region, given how much cotton and how much textile production happens there. So this is huge.
I mean, China is pretty insular. How do you think the U.S. government is going to be able to enforce this ban?
It's now up to companies to ensure that the goods that they are importing into the U.S. don't contain any cotton products from the Uyghur region. So they need to map their supply chains and they need to disengage so that their goods aren't stopped at the border. I mean, the entire garment supply chain is going to have to be doing some serious work to look at their sourcing practices and really redirecting their sourcing to other places.
What has generally been the Trump administration's view of what's been happening in Xinjiang? Have they brought enough pressure to bear? And do you think Joe Biden will take a ban like this and do more?
Despite the many problems with the Trump-China policy, the Trump administration has taken some really important steps on Uyghur forced labor and on other abuses against Uyghurs. And so we're hopeful that the Biden administration will continue to pursue those policies. This is about human rights and forced labor. And this cannot be tolerated in this century, that there is a crime against humanity on a mass scale happening with a major economy. I mean, we're used to taking these kinds of steps on smaller countries, but China is a global player and they have a massive global economy. So this is really a different beast altogether.
Allison Gill, the Forced Labor Program Director with Global Labor Justice International Labor Rights Forum, speaking with us about the new U.S. ban on cotton and tomatoes from China's Xinjiang region. Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
How to repair urban blight. Policymakers everywhere wrestle with this. In Istanbul, artists have transformed an abandoned apartment building into a temporary art exhibit. They call it Mikrotopia, an idealized world showing off graffiti, paintings, and sculpture in a space waiting for demolition. Duri Biskaran visited and sent us this audio postcard.
A horned wooden creature sits perched over the side of a crumbling third-floor balcony. Like a skeletal gargoyle, it holds a wind chime of spoons over the street below.
Like a totem, the protector sculpture for this building.
Barak Chizer created the sculpture with materials he found in the vacant apartment building that has become a museum nearly overnight.
Dedim ya, binanın artık parçalarından oluşturuldu.
Chizer is one of 16 artists who have turned this four-story building in Istanbul's Fenerbahçe district into an exhibit of found items and urban art. They call it Mikrotopia. Bright, colorful monsters with razor-sharp teeth adorn the walls of one apartment. A tree, sculpted out of a pile of discarded clothing, seems to gaze wistfully out of a hole that was once a bedroom window. In another section, a fancy parquet floor and vintage crown molding now frame the image of a soldier crouching with a sniper's gun, tied to the strings of a puppet master. Nearby, pairs of shoes sit outside an apartment door, as if they were having a party that never left. It's cold, and our feet crunch over broken glass as a family of street cats beg for attention. In a puffy jacket, Batikhan Bostanji leads me to his exhibit. He's painted textured stripes and pigments over sections of concrete relief pulled from the construction site. They're images of people, but their faces are obscured, almost murky. He calls them powerless faces. When I first came here, he says, I felt like nothing here belonged to the present. It no longer had an owner, and I felt like nothing in this place could be right or wrong. The residents of this building, Bostanji explains, were moved temporarily while the building is demolished. They've been promised apartments in the new development, which may be taller, sleeker, more modern. But they might not match the neighborhood's original seaside feel, full of wide balconies and gardens with orange trees. I followed their progress because I was curious, Bostanji says. They just want this building to be demolished as soon as possible, so they can live in their own homes. The project's curator is Begum Tekay, a tiny brunette with a ceramic studio next door. Every day, she watches the reactions of the people who visit the site, especially the people who used to live here.
Some of them were really sad, some were really happy. Their experience was important to me.
To Tekay, Mikrotopia is a tiny version of an artist's utopia. If the world around you isn't perfect, you can create a tiny world of your own with the things you have around you. And if what you have around you is an abandoned building that might not be here tomorrow, so be it.
What we need to do here is, instead of imagining what we can't do, we should focus on what is actually possible.
Since November, Tekay says, contractors tell her that the building is going to be demolished next week. Every week, she says, they don't actually come, and Mikrotopia lives for another day. For The World, I'm Duri Biskaran, Istanbul.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be healthy, and we will see you back here with more tomorrow.